You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Dan Tillemans. I'll get this right sooner or later. Dan, it's good to have you here this morning.
Okay, you're the first person that's pronounced my name correctly on the radio, so I appreciate getting that right. Thank you.
So the way we begin the show is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know to kind of start this conversation about the quality of life you aspire to live, the labels you wear, some of the things, places you've been, things you've done?
Well, first of all, you know, at my age, I realize that I'm a temporary life form. So I have to start out with...
You mean your death on the make?
Well, three-fourths of my life is over. And when we live our lives, you know, realizing that we are temporary, mm-hmm. it can help us focus on, you know, what's worth doing while we're here. So I'll start out by saying that I'm a Homo sapien, and I'm one of 7 billion on this planet trying to figure out what the hell is going on.
Right.
And my personal life, you know, who am I in a community... I lead wilderness trips. I'm a naturalist. I've been the director of Cornell University Outdoor Education for 15 years, so I've done a lot of leadership stuff. I lead people in the Himalayas and in Ecuador and in the Rocky Mountains, and I love being in the outdoors for a personal connection and just helping other people to realize that connection for themselves.
That's neat. We'll get into that later. What music should we start the show with? What should we go to?
Well, I did a lot of hitchhiking in between high school and college, and that had a big impact on my life. So, let's just jump in with Bob Dylan. I mean, Blowing in the Wind. Let's go there, and then maybe we can see what happens after that.
Okie doke. So, I've got it right here, and here we go.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? How many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many years can a mountain exist before it's washed to the sea? How many can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? How many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing. Times must a man look up before he really sees the sky? How many ears must one person have before he can hear people cry? How many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Dan Tillemans. So, Dan, given the life that you value now, that you've been living, I imagine, for a number of years, what did you have to learn? What did you have to come to accept? You know, what did you find maybe out on the road or gathered together as you were coming up in this world, so that you learned what you needed to know to live the life you value now?
Well, first of all, I started out with very good parents and a good childhood. I grew up in a town of 3,000 people on the North Dakota border.
Oh, really?
I don't know very many people that are from Breckenridge, Minnesota. In fact, those would be my classmates. So I started there.
Breckenridge, Minnesota, yeah.
There is a town called Breckenridge, Minnesota. Not Breckenridge, Colorado.
Yeah, Breckenridge, Minnesota. I think there's a Breckenridge, Missouri, too. I'm from Missouri.
Oh, so. There you go. I'm sorry for sliding. I didn't mean
no,
to.
No. I'm decent.
So I knew at a very young age that I was interested in nature. I spent time building boats and hanging out on the river. And by the time I was 17, I knew, well before that, I had a strong connection with nature. So what's been important to me? A connection with nature. And as I've grown older, I've shared that connection with other people, and I've spent a lot of time researching universal mythology with Joseph Campbell, Jung, and looking at how do humans connect with nature. And for me, that's it. I mean, that's our source. That's where we're from. There's no man in nature. There's just humans, and we're connected with nature.
Right.
So that's been a driving theme in my life. And my parents, again, were very good role models. I was 17 years old when I got on a bicycle and rode from Minnesota to Wyoming. My family didn't have money, so if you're going to go to the mountains, that's the way I did it.
Right.
And then that changed my life. I wrote a letter to my high school principal and said, I know what I want to do. You know, I've got good grades. I'm out of here in half a year. And then I hitchhiked through much of the United States. I led wilderness trips in the Rocky Mountains. The biggest impact of anything I've ever done in my life, when I was 21 years old, I did a 100-day solo wilderness hike from Utah to Mexico through all of the life zones in the western U.S. and identified every bird and plant and animal I could find and sent it out to my professors. But in retrospect, it was a spiritual journey.
Yes.
Yeah. It just totally submerged oneself with nature. It costs about $3 a day, by the way, just for food.
Right.
And there's no group dynamics problems. The only person you can't get along with would be yourself. But there's just a peacefulness.
And sometimes that's an issue, but
it can be. Well, sometimes Tillemans did some really stupid stuff that I need to call him on. But just that sense of every time a bird chirps or every time you see something, you investigate it. And for me, that's changed my life. And it's the single most powerful experience in my life to this day.
Right, right. So so you just described a rite of passage. So literally a 100 days passage.
That's what it was.
So what was the Tillemans that began that 100 day walk, and how did that Tillemans change by the end, and how long did it take you to figure it out?
Well, the person that went on the walk was just tremendously curious, enthusiastic. You know, life is great. It's wonderful to be alive. A great adventure. You know, let's go out and do something.
He was game.
Oh yeah. You know, and so, but also there's some depth there. Not just fun and games, but like, who am I? How do I fit into the universe? You know,
you were playing a deadly serious game.
And I could have died on that trip.
Yeah.
You know, I had to call my mother every 10 days. And in hindsight, it's like, yes. Yeah, but there's a realization that comes along with it. You swim across the Grand Canyon illegally, you know, and there are snakes out there, and there are things that if you make one mistake, you don't show up at the resupply. And there's no cell phones back then. So coming and finding my body, you know, the coyotes would have been chewing on it by then.
Right. They'd have found some bones if they were lucky.
Yeah. So in any event, it wasn't actually that more. It was a highlight in my life. And then moving forward, also just having that connection with nature, that's a spiritual peace that I realize that we all can have.
Right.
And what's changed? Gosh, I look around at the mess. I wasn't really that politically active because when I was younger, I just avoided all that crap. And now, because I'm a leader of an organization and people turn to me for leadership, I look at what's going on in the country and they're like, Dan, why is this happening? And so what's changed for me is the realization that we really do not help people understand what the goal is. In other words, feeling good should be the goal. And yet so many people are on this treadmill doing, you know, trying to keep up with the neighbors. And that's not, people are not happy doing that.
Right, but there's feeling good a la connected, and there's feeling good like, you know, you just got to get high again, which is addiction. So, I mean, I'm assuming you're talking about the first one.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up getting high, you know, with drugs.
I'm talking about addiction versus connection.
Yeah.
And you can use drugs to find connection.
Well, those drugs that we get high on, I've studied meditation.
Sure.
We can make them. We should be teaching people to sit down and make the dopamine
in their own bodies.
In their own lives.
Yes.
In their
yes,
bodies.
Yes,
we
yes,
don't
yes.
have to go and get synthetic dopamine. We can make it ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think one of the things that I feel pretty strongly about is that in our education systems, we don't create safety for people. I do teamwork and leadership development mm-hmm. programs now. And just creating a safe space where a person can be who they are so that they feel good. People don't feel good. I mean, we're never good enough. We go to our school, we're not good enough. We go on the mm-hmm. playground, we're not good enough. We go home, we're not good. We're never good enough. And
right.
so, you know, there's an aspect of Buddhism where you appreciate the moment, but mm-hmm. that's very difficult to do when the people around you are telling you you're not good enough. So I think we need a paradigm shift as to what the goal is. The goal is not making money, folks. I mean, that's in and of itself is not happiness.
Right, right. And there's the achievement goals, and then there are also the kind of the appearance goals, you know, which have to do with notions of perfection and beauty, which are kind of not realistic either.
Well, I think, again, there's an education gap. Later in life, in my 30s, I started to look more at universal mythology. Joseph Campbell, mm-hmm. in particular, and Carl Jung have had a big influence on my thinking. And in terms of universal mythology, Joseph Campbell will talk about the animal within. And I'll turn to Jared Diamond, and now I realize I'm 98.7% chimp. Well, you know, that only leaves 1.3%. So to transcend the animal within, which in Buddhism, you know, is greed and selfishness, and mm-hmm. it's this monkey mind, which leads us to unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
But unless we understand where that's coming from, how, and many people don't even, 50% of the people don't even admit, you know, that evolution exists. Well, we're fighting, you know, a battle which is basically a social status driven battle. Mm-hmm. In the chimps, you know, every male chimp is numbered 1 through 13 or however many
right,
males
in terms
there
of
are.
Hierarchy.
And we do that in our society, and that's not a fun place to be because you're just always fighting for social status. That's not the goal. The goal is fulfillment and peace, and we don't teach people how to do that, and we also don't create a group atmosphere that allows that because there's just people are competing all the time.
Right, right, right.
I got off on a tangent.
Perhaps. This is a really, it's a really good tangent. There's just a lot of stuff in here. So when you were on that 100-day walk, you are stripped down to your capacity to relate to something way beyond your control.
That's right.
And most people don't willingly submit to that. I mean, the life of faith or the life of spiritual discipline begins when you submit to the fact that you don't control it at all. And what matters is your ability to engage or respond and to remain as centered in that moment. Whether you get wiped out or not is kind of irrelevant because you're going to get wiped out sooner or later.
Sooner or later. Good point.
But your ability to respond is key.
Well,
And then you have this notion that any other interactions you have with human beings have a fundamentally different flavor after you have been stripped down to that level of being engaged or responsive. You just don't treat people the same way, is my guess.
Well, education is a journey. So, I look at the 21-year-old and I now see some faults, you know, and I have more wisdom. And hopefully by tomorrow.
So what were the faults that you kind of felt that you see now that 21-year-old had to come out of?
Well,
or to learn how to live with.
I'm reflecting on stages of development, which are kind of especially outlined in Eastern religions, where we start out innocent and then we develop a sense of self or ego,
mm-hmm.
and then we move on to achievement phase. For me, it was, you know, being the director of a big outdoor education program, but it was kind of mixed with doing good and growing. It was a personal growth path also. But then, you know, as we get older in the East, we say, you know, you go to the forest. It's like, I've already done all of this materialism right. stuff. I've pursued that. It's shallow. You know, now my phase in life is to reflect more on, you know, what's important and to, you know, to try to analyze what is peace and happiness mm-hmm. and how does that go together. I was raised Roman Catholic, and I had, a fabulous childhood. What was maybe different from some people that were raised Catholic is that my parents were true Christians. I mean, they gave money to the poor, and they treated everyone equally, and they mm-hmm. followed, you know, what I would call the original teachings of Jesus of Nazareth, which I think most of us know what those are. So later in life, I started to listen to Joseph Campbell, and I realized that's essentially the same philosophy of Buddhism. Jesus and Buddha basically taught the same thing.
And Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a book on that.
And it's not new, yeah, you know. Yeah. And before I lose this thought, I've been to Nepal 6 times, and I've led treks there, and I've done some high-altitude climbing. But every time I go, I like to listen to it. A teaching. We go to a Tibetan mm-hmm. Buddhist monastery, and there's a teacher, hope I say his name right, Choki Naima Rinpoche, who was appointed by the Dalai Lama to bring Buddhism to the West. And there was one point that was a turning point for me, because it was just a 20-minute teaching, and he only hit 3 points. Took him 20 minutes to say 3 things. Mm-hmm. And he started out saying, and he's talking to a Western crowd, although not a lot of Americans, you know, Russians, Europeans, mm-hmm. a lot of foreigners, in this shrine room. And of course, he's got this really cool accent, so whatever he says sounds mm-hmm. really cool. But there were 3 points. And the first thing he said, you know, if you go and get a new car, or you go buy a new house, mm-hmm. or you get a new relationship, you know, you'll be happy in the future. You know, I'm planning to be happy in the future. And his point was, you know, the happiness is in the mind. If you create the mental state now, you can be happy now. So his first point was to appreciate, just mm-hmm. simply appreciate. And I realized we're not taught that in the West, because wherever we are, we're not done. We got to be somewhere else.
Right.
So appreciate, and the second thing, which is actually a Christian teaching too, but we don't practice it, you know, be on good terms with everyone. And what was interesting, his point was, if you're going to be free, if you're going to be happy, if you're going to be content, stop fighting in your mind with your partner that you had the argument with this morning, or your kid that's not doing what you want, or your boss. So we're always in our minds, we're not happy because we're angry with someone. He said, diffuse that, just reach out to that person. You won't necessarily resolve the problem, but you can say, you know, I'll take 100% responsibility. Right. Now, that frees that person. And then right. his third point was celebrate the success of others instead of being jealous or envious mm-hmm. of what that other person has mm-hmm. celebrated. Right. And those 3 points, I thought, wow, that's yeah. simple. That's not that complicated.
Right. Right.
And it's actually the Christian teaching underneath, the way I understand it, yeah. at least. Yeah. Yeah. So it just impacted me. It's like, just keep it simple. That's all you got to do. But the appreciate the moment, we have to remind ourselves to just do that all the time.
Right, right. For me, I've heard that the rhetoric appreciate the moment a lot. For me, it's more helpful to hear, what are you curious about?
Oh, there you go.
So the minute you hear you put the word curiosity, I'm like, you know, Curious George, you know, I'm out there. But appreciate is a word that didn't really sing with me, but it's just a matter of semantics. They get you the same sort
well,
of place.
Well, semantics are important. So, for example, I have an issue with the goal of Buddhism being happy. That's too shallow for me. That's hedonistic. It's like fulfillment being, if the goal, and by the way, the Pali word doesn't translate
right. yeah,
precisely
yeah, yeah.
No, being
no,
happy.
No, yeah, yeah.
But it's like, how do I find contentment? And for example,
or joy, which is the traditional Christian word for the same concept.
So again, we're running into semantics. Yeah, yeah, words yeah, are the yeah, best yeah, things yeah, yeah. we've got to convey this.
Right. Wait, but I'm gonna push back here
okay.
a little bit on the developmental piece, because
okay.
I actually in my own work. I worked with James Fowler's developmental models, stages of faith, which mirrored what you
okay.
just said, only okay. from using a traditional Christian method.
Okay.
And I just said, you know, this is fine, but I have known people who are using the skill set associated with each stage, Now, they may be more or less emphasized, but we do all of those things at all points in life. So in my dissertation work, I began to take apart the skillfulness of people using different, each, looking at a stage as a skill set. And you need to own each skill set kind of at all stages of your life. But the way in which you own it, what you're good at, what you're not so good at, is going to be different. And it's not a matter of kind of going through the developmental stages, which can be as onerous as a success story for some people, or kind of making sure that you're in the right place, which really is not always the place where you actually are. You know, in terms of the right that you project versus the right that is. So, again, we're playing with words here, and I don't mean to be too pedantic, but it's funny how we each kind of find the struggle for fulfillment.
I work with high performance teamwork, and, uh-huh. and I work with Myers-Briggs types, and so the path of individuation for each person is unique.
Uh-huh.
So what makes this person content or happy might be, you know, like, you know, building a building.
Yep.
You know, another person, it might be playing music, and someone else, it might be hanging out with their friends.
Right. Or celebrating the other, just in wonder.
So each person, you know, is rewarded differently. I think the common theme is that that the goal is, I want everybody to feel okay about being who they are, and create that environment. You know, as long as you're not stepping on other people.
Yeah.
You know, that curiosity and that adventure. And I'm going to talk just for a moment about Flo.
Right. Yeah.
Csikszentmihalyi, if I said his name correctly. You know, he's the professor from the University of Chicago who has studied, like, when do people feel really good? They mm-hmm. lose track of time. They're content. Mm-hmm. And so he's done massive amounts of study on this. But I look at that and I say, well, okay, that's just Buddhism. You know, like, how do I find peace and happiness and contentment? And he applies it, well, everywhere, but in a Western lifestyle, you don't just have to sit down and meditate to be content. You know, it's like the rock climber is focused on climbing. And so
when they're climbing and not when they're not.
That's right. Yeah. But they're in this state of flow. A musician can reach flow. Mm-hmm. A carpenter making a set of cabinets or...
The Christian language for that is state of grace. And so, for example, I can tell you the times when I had the counters that were unlevel, and if I put an egg on them, it would roll off if I wasn't paying attention or if I didn't put it down the right way. When I was in a state of grace, I would catch it before it hit the floor.
There you go.
If I was at all kind of preoccupied or not connected to the moment, I could not respond in time to catch it before it hit the floor. And the state of grace is an unselfconscious responsiveness. When you become self-conscious, you lose it, and that is very much at the core of Christian teaching.
Well, I like the way that you're applying Christian teaching. I'm not a big fan of certain Old Testament types of applications.
Well, but actually, the Old Testament, I mean, I worked with the kind of the feminist, the matriarch of feminist biblical studies, Phyllis Tribble, and taking the Old Testament apart. And so there's a whole lot more there, especially if you look at it from the point of view of the remnant or the survivor, or how you maintain yourself in the face of powers you cannot alter, which is where we find ourselves a lot.
Well, I'll agree that there's wisdom in the book.
Yeah.
Anything
can be misused.
That's right.
Even Buddhism, and we have the issue with the Rohingya now, and that's
I agree. That's why I don't jump on board with any particular faith. One of the things that's kind of helped me to look at what are the, in my way of looking at it, what are the common key important things about Christian teachings.
Sure.
I was raised Christian, you know, that are universal.
Yep.
Because there's not just one path. I think, you know, whatever the spiritual path is, I think it's common to every culture, every person on the planet. That's logical. And looking at human evolution and the things that drive all of us are curiosities. And for some of us, at least, we're looking for peace and contentment. Uh-huh. Some people, I wonder, I actually don't think they are. But that's another story.
Well, but did you have a thought you wanted to finish? Because I want to come back on that.
I'll let you go.
One of the things that I have come to appreciate is at some point, in almost a codependent way, I wanted people to find peace and contentment. But what I've learned is that, how's it working for you? How's this particular struggle working for you? And that actually will induce an awareness that this is meaningful. And that's not necessarily peace and contentment in what we normally think of it as, but it allows the struggle to be meaningful, and sometimes it's rigorous, and sometimes it's soft, and sometimes it's violent, and sometimes it's nonviolent. And if we're not afraid of those things, we can be.
Well, one of the elements of flow is that there needs to be an element of challenge. And in my work, I take people, okay, climbing in the Himalayas or in Ecuador or in Yosemite. I mean, why do we do that? It's deliberate, you know, because there's going to be a sense of adventure. You don't know what's going to happen next. Right. There's a little skin in the game. Yes, you could get killed if you don't tie in correctly, so you pay attention.
But if you tie in correctly, you're pretty sure to be safe.
If you do it all right, yeah, you know, you're going to have an experience that's memorable. And what's interesting for me, when I look back, it's like, there's times when I'm in the wilderness when I can rebuild the whole day from the beginning to the end of the day. And by the way, I've spent a lot of time in the office, and I don't remember those days. And so it's just interesting that when we're alive and there's an adventure, uh-huh, yep, that, you know, I identify that with flow, or identify that. Mm-hmm. And you're right. It's not all peace and contentment and happiness. That's the goal. You know, the goal is personal growth. But we need to stretch. This is something that Csikszentmihalyi will say, that, you know, once you've mastered a particular thing, you naturally want to stretch to the next level.
You don't have to do it anymore. You do something.
It's not as rewarding. Else. It's too easy. So you have to go do something. Yeah. So
pick a discipline. Any discipline, you're going to have to change it sooner or later.
So it's just interesting to reflect on these things. I can see that you and I could do this for a long time.
No, and this is and what's really, I mean, I have found that in studying the different religions, whether they're the same thing or slightly different, just studying one deeper allows you to penetrate or to appreciate or stand within your own or the others in a way that's just wow.
One of the ahas for me, Carl Jung wrote a piece on the Christ within, and basically, the Myers-Briggs types and the different extremes of personalities, which we're all really, really different. He studies them, but ultimately the goal is to go to the self. And when I look at the description of what that is, you know, my reading has suggested that the stories about Jesus and the stories about Siddhartha, they're really stretched a lot of times, and we don't know exactly what happened. We know they lived, but it's not critical necessarily to get it all right, because we never will. But the message is interesting, because what we wanted them to say is what was written. Right. In other words, we wanted them to be like this. And so when I look at that, it's like, okay, you know, this is the Christ archetype. And so when you strip back all the layers, it's like this is a universal theme, or the Buddha archetype.
Right.
But, and then we can, so for example, when fundamental Christians are looking to convert me, I take this conversation to, if we would just do what Jesus would do, everything would be fine.
Right.
And we don't have to argue about all the details, right, because we're in agreement there.
Right.
And intuitively, we know what that is.
Right.
And so that's the common theme for me. Let's just go for that archetype. Right. We know what that is, and let's act like that.
So you and this is where you and I have a stylistic difference.
Okay, go ahead.
One is that you, by going to the archetype, you go for the big generalization that is very powerful, and by my personality, I go for the specifics. The stories, there are four different gospels. They completely contradict each other in terms,
right,
of how Jesus got here. They completely contradict each other in terms of the end. They contradict each other often internally. So when somebody wants to come at me and argue with me, I'm going to say, well, that's fine. You can do that, but you just wiped out all of this other contrary evidence. And so I want to take them into the specifics. And this may be where I'm not so much looking for peace and joy as I'm looking for a good, meaningful struggle. And that may be part of what I am. But I can also meet with the evangelical pastors, which I do, and they kind of question, are you really a Christian? I say, well, all of these other things that I'm familiar with have deepened my appreciation. So I can engage you just as effectively as anybody else around the table and stand as one of you, but I can also stand as one with the other without renouncing any of them. You know, and that's, that for me has become a critical discipline, but that's my own personal path.
Well, the people that get it, women or men, we've been talking a lot about men.
Yeah, that's true.
They're at peace with themselves, and they're not threatened by someone else with a different
And they have a belief. High tolerance for conflict.
That's right.
And uncertainty.
And also, tolerance. It's because if you're going to be at peace with yourself, you've got to find that peace within. And you just because someone else, you know, is attacking you or has a different point of view, to be knocked off balance, that just means that the peace within isn't. Maybe you have to walk away, which is probably what I would do if it gets too bad.
Well, and the thing is what I've had to learn, the hardest lesson for me to learn, is that the walking away means that this person really doesn't want to engage you. There's too much at risk in that engagement, and you can escalate because I'm comfortable going to higher and higher levels of conflict. But if it's not comfortable for the other person, I need to just walk away.
I don't like fighting. You know, like where I go for peace, it's like, okay, this is a mess. You know, clearly this is going in the wrong direction.
Right, right.
You know, I'll go for a run in one of the gorges around here and connect with nature. And then also, I think it's important to look at the size of the problem. You know, this is one planet. You know, life is 3.8 billion years old.
Right.
And one of the things that's at least kind of a place where I go that's more peaceful is to realize that the evolution of life on this planet is not specific to just end up with human beings.
Right.
It's a random process, and we're part of what I will call almost a miracle. We can study it. But there's no conflict between science and spirituality, because people that really get the science.
There's no conflict between science and religion, from my point of view, because you can.
Well, depending on, I'll differ with you there, because depending on how religion is interpreted, religio is linking back. So the earth is no longer flat. If we're going to argue about that.
Religio is religament, to bind together again that which is torn apart. So how we put things together is our religion. So I ask people, what did you do when your life fell apart? And they will often say they're Christian, but none of what they did had anything to do with Christianity or Buddhism or whatever they espouse. So,
it doesn't have to be linked to a particular tradition. And going backwards is not the way forwards. I would say evidence-based spirituality.
I haven't found a religion that's not in some sense evidence-based. So what I do is I engage people with the evidence that they use and make suggestions that is that the best evidence that you can bring to the table, or is there better evidence in your tradition? And in almost every case, there's better evidence that they can find, that they would claim.
When we look at where humans came from, we don't need a creation myth. We know where we came from now, which is, honestly, it's really invigorating for me to realize that there's no line between us and the rest of the life on the planet. Everything is related. You know, like the native tradition of the brother bear, sister deer, of course.
It's related, but not the same.
Well, the DNA, you know, if we look at it from a scientific
in a very fine point of technicality, it's not the same. It's deeply related, almost exactly the same, but then it's not.
Well, a cat is not the same as a dog.
Okay,
so humans are not the same as bonobos, although our DNA is like 98.7% the same. But that link is important for me, because now there's a sense of belonging. It's not like humans were just dropped down here randomly, you know, and the animals and all the rest of the life, created to take care of us. We're part of it. We're in the middle of it.
And for you, the belonging comes from the general connection, the generalized connection. And for me, the belonging comes from the uniqueness that each and every one individual critter, not just species, brings to the table. The belonging is the way in which we engage or don't engage each other. So
it's astounding. I mean, just to think that my body would work for 5 minutes while I'm speaking with you.
Yeah.
Because when I just take a moment to reflect on, you know, my white blood cells are running around doing all kinds of things, to take care of, you know, the flu that I had a couple of weeks ago, or, you know, my eyes are working, the light's working. And we just take all of this kind of for granted. And I'm like, guys, you know, this is absolutely credibly astounding. You know, stop worrying, you know, about the present you didn't get for your birthday. Just appreciate being alive.
Right.
But then, okay, I'm a naturalist, so I go out, I go watch birds. I go watch mammals. I track animals, and I can see, you know, a lot of the same behaviors as a naturalist. You know, our behaviors are not Okay, humans are more unique than most other mammals, and our brains are, I think, 3 times larger than a chimp. But so what? You know, it's just a matter of degree. We're still mammals on the planet, and we're part of this system. And for me, I think that's really important because most people don't realize we are a part of this system. We're in the middle of this thing, and it's amazing.
And I think that people may realize it, but they may not express it with the conviction because it's part of the ground of your being. And for other people, the awareness can exist but not be at the ground of their being.
I think you're right. It's kind of a superficial awareness. But then also, we're social animals. And so most of our energy is like, what's going on with the people around me? And what's my social standing? And what am I wearing right now? And how do I look? And did I say the right thing at the breakfast table this morning? And that consumes like 99.9% of our time. And then also, you know, we want to fit in with, you know, I need to drive a BMW. You know, I need to do this. I send my kids to the school, you know, and that's our lives for most people.
I guess I grew up in a pre-modern environment. I grew up mentored by people who were born in the 1880s and 1890s and early 1900s. They had a different sensibility. It was fundamentally not what you described.
Okay.
And but what you have described is the dominant public face of our culture. What should we play music? I'm going to do the station ID and you think about what to play. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Dan Tillemans.
Let's play Be Thou My Vision. This is my daughter got married and played this piece at her wedding, so it's kind of cool.
Yes. It is a classic of... Thank you. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Dan Tillemans. So, Dan, how have you had to change in ways you would neither have predicted nor chosen? You know, what have you had to kind of confront that kind of pushed you in ways that you were not quite ready?
That's an interesting question. I came kicking and screaming to Ithaca. My wife at the time wanted to finish her degree because we had our children when we were young. And I wanted to be out west in the mountains. I just, I would lead five
I get the kicking and screaming.
And it's kind of gray around here. And there's not, the mountains aren't big enough, not like the Rockies. So anyway, I came here in 84 with two young children, a five-year-old and a three-year-old. And I was only planning to be here for 2 years. And then we were going to go back west. And I had some other job offers that I was interested in. So what changed? I ended up, I took a pay cut to come here. I was working at the National Outdoor Leadership School. And they put together a job at Cornell just to pay me enough to support my family, which honestly probably wasn't enough to support my family. But I had an 11-month contract, and I had 1 month off, and I would lead trips to Wyoming every year for June. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a tangent, but I was reflecting on how those undergraduate students frequently spot that 1 3-week wilderness expedition in Wyoming as the most important experience in their life, mm-hmm. or one of the most.
Sure. Yeah.
So again, it validates this is important. You know, this is where we go back to our source. And there's also a sense of Sebastian Younger wrote a book called Tribe, and he talks about the way that we treat other people in a tribal situation. Yeah. I realized that a wilderness expedition is like that.
It creates an instant tribe.
Well, being selfish doesn't work out there, and being ego-driven doesn't work. None of that stuff works. But the beauty is that when you create an environment where people work together and they support each other and everybody brings a different skill set, it's a win-win. And for a lot of people, this is like the best of the best, mm-hmm. you know, plus the spiritual connection with nature. So I would lead those wilderness expeditions and then develop relationships with undergraduate students, which would teach our trips. And then I start to mentor them, not just with the outdoor skills, but also, you know, with how do you lead a group? How do you create safety? You know, how do you make sure to get someone out if they get sick? Mm-hmm. So there's all these real responsibilities. And people respond to that. So I realized how powerful that was. I was just doing what I considered my passion or my job. I'm leading trips, and I'm into all this stuff. I'm enthralled with it. It's like, that's what I do.
Yep.
So I didn't expect these pieces to fall into place, but there are some alumni around Cornell that have money, and there are some trustees that have a lot of money, and they took an interest in this project. And so I built this advisory board, and it wasn't Cornell that supplied the money to build Cornell Outdoor Education. It was the alumni.
Right.
So like 95% of our budget is fee-based. I've run a nonprofit, you know, and we use the Cornell name, and yes, they give us insurance and they give us, you know, a heated space, but the money to run the operation and pay all the staff, everything, you know, it's an enterprise operation. Mm-hmm. So what changed? Well, I'm still here. I came here in 1984. Mm-hmm. There was a personal growth path that was kind of set up right there. In other words, my leadership skills, I was mainly a wilderness trip leader.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at Cornell University, to interface with the administration, with the alumni, to raise the money, and to find some way to thread that needle through all of the red tape is very, very challenging. I'm fortunate that both of my parents, in different ways, my mother is the manager and my father is the salesman, and their Myers-Briggs types are completely opposite. My mother's an INTJ, my father's an ENFP. So he's the salesman. He gets in front of the group and talk. Mom runs everything. But in any event, I saw both of these modeled, and so in terms of providing leadership for Cornell Outdoor Education, I had a good, you know, role models to pull from, sometimes from mom and sometimes from dad, and then sometimes from who knows where.
Right.
So I think at the time, I was kind of naive about the big picture. I just loved what I did. Mm-hmm. And I was also raised where there really wasn't much classism. I come from a town of 3,000 people. for better or for worse, everybody's, you know, from an immigrant family. They're European immigrants.
Right.
You know, and so, and it didn't matter if you had any money in Breckenridge. You know, the movie theater ticket was a quarter, no matter how much money you had.
Right.
So unlike a lot of people that grow up where you need to fight for your turf, I never experienced that. So when I come to Cornell, honestly, I was pretty naive about the differences between the elite. And plus, having done this 100-day solo walk, you know, in the same way that Jesus or Buddha, I don't care how much money you have. Who are you?
Right.
You know, your wealth is in your character.
Right. You know where the question comes from that starts the show.
And so the common theme here is let's go out in the wilderness. Yeah. And so, yes, the alumni, that was when they were alive. And they were like, okay, I'll take you on the wilderness. I'll help you experience this. Now, you help us build this program, you know, to educate these students. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of in the middle, kind of trying to keep all the pieces together, which was very challenging. It was very busy. But I didn't expect that. Like, when I was younger, I thought, you know, I'm going to go north. I'm going to build a log cabin. And I'm Daniel Boone or Davy Crockett. You know, I don't want anything to do with this, you know, domestic lifestyle.
Right.
And so where am I? I'm in an Ivy League school, you know, running a budget, which is, I don't know, $1.5 million, you know, and doing all kinds of stuff with computers. Mm-hmm. And I'm holding the pieces. What am I really doing? I'm talking about doing outdoor stuff. And then I go outdoors, you know, to run a few high-end expeditions each year. But most of the time, I'm organizing stuff.
Right.
I didn't expect that when I was younger. So that was a change.
Right. And how has your self-perception changed?
I think I met some other people. Clint Seidel is a colleague of mine who was on our advisory board and has had an influence on my thinking. We've led a number of trips together. He's my Myers-Briggs opposite, by the way. Uh-huh. So
he suggested I invite you.
I'm aware of that, yes. Yeah. And he told me that I need to get ready to tell you who comes next. But Clint and I, because he's my opposite, he thinks about things completely opposite the way I do. And yet we agree on, you know, the goal, you know, the personal growth goal. Yep. So he brings things. I'm like, do you really think this way? And he's like, yeah, he does. I'm like, oh, my God, you know, this is radical. So that's my growing edge, though. Uh-huh. So that in our leadership model, you know, we're born with a certain natural tendency. You know, we may be task-oriented or we may be relationship-oriented. Mm-hmm. But it's important to know where your preference is, because when I teach leadership now, you got to cover everything. So you start out, you can cover these two, you know, buckets, but you got to cover all four. And what's interesting is with this model, that's also the path toward personal growth. So leadership is not ego-driven. It's not about making a bunch of money. It's not about winning.
Right.
It's about growing. And when you shift that, and in wilderness trips especially, that's the only goal we have. Right. It's personal growth. And so it's like, cool. You know, I fell into a situation where it was just, I wouldn't have grown this much if I had stayed at the National Outdoor Leadership School, because I need to be able to articulate, you know, what is this personal growth, and then also explore with Clint and with others, you know, explore, like, how do you teach this so that undergraduate students get it?
Right.
So that became, it wasn't just the wilderness connection now, it's the group stuff.
Right.
It's the leadership stuff. And the high performance teamwork side. And so that has been very rich. I've been really fortunate and lucky.
Mm-hmm. And I want to reflect a little bit. People who actually do a disconnect from mainstream society, and they do it, and they can become caricatures of themselves because they stop growing. Or they can become like my uncle, who was a member both of the NRA, the National Rifle Association, and of the Sierra Club, and he paid to National Public Radio and gave to public television. He saw himself as deeply connected in the world and lost of different directions, but he lived on this little farm in Northwest Missouri. And he planted 3 or 5 different vegetables every year that he'd never seen before. So he got this was his way, and this was a curiosity about the world, even though he, in some sense, withdrew. He remained engaged, but he was planted firmly in Northwest Missouri, and he wasn't moving. And you came here and got pulled to learn personality types and skills and things that you had not really anticipated, and you didn't become a caricature of yourself, which could have happened if you've remained isolated.
Well, one of the things that Being a self-directed, self-motivated learner is a goal that I believe needs to be taught in every school system, because every day we get up, we can learn something.
Right.
And by the way, that's a lot of what I do these days. I listen to a lot of podcasts and a lot of the great courses, different lectures, you know, just to try to stay up with human evolution and physics and different things. But I got off on a tangent. Where were we?
About being, well, you wanted to introduce self-directed leaders, and that needs to be taught. And before that, I was talking about the risks of becoming isolated.
Oh, that's the connection I wanted to make. You know, Joseph Campbell talks about the hero's journey or the inward journey. Mm-hmm. We can call it different things.
Right.
But every person does that to a certain extent. But as we identify, you know, we give ourselves over to something bigger than ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at something that's really, really rewarding, when we talk to the spiritual teachers, it's about giving. And okay, I think Dan Harris interviewed the Dalai Lama and said, well, isn't it ultimately selfish? And the Dalai Lama says, yes, everything we do ultimately is selfish. But, you know, when you meditate on helping a person across the road, you feel good.
Well, and the thing is yourself this big, or is yourself the size of the universe?
And getting to the size of the universe, and by the way, I just noticed you put your arms all the way out.
Yeah.
It's that kind of thinking that I think is, for me, it's been expansive. You know, I've read Cosmos by Carl Sagan, and there's a lecture series out by David Christian called The Big History, where you start with a big bang and you end up with humans. Like, how the hell did this happen? You know, but it's that kind of thinking. And then when you look at the day-to-day problems, it's like people, you know, this is only one planet. You know, you're 3.8 billion years old. Mm-hmm. You know, your cell life never died. You know, this is incredible. You know, appreciate it. And let's stop fighting about, you know, how big a piece of the pie and how much money I'm making. Because ultimately, you know, happiness doesn't... You need food, clothing, and shelter.
Right.
But for me, honestly, that's about it. I would rather be out in the desert with food, clothing, and shelter under the stars than in some 5-star hotel, you know, with all of these comforts. And good God, the goddamn fans, excuse me, I'm not supposed to say it, fans are blowing, you know, and making noises. Get me out of here. I don't need it.
Yeah. I want to, and in kind of in keeping with the direction that you just took it, but taking it kind of deeper, more inward. What do you do to take care of yourself emotionally, intellectually, physically? Which they're orthogonal axes, but they add up to spiritual for me. From my point of view. But what do you do to take care of yourself? How do you know when you need to do it? And throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly.
Okay. This is a fascinating conversation, by the way, because I'm so comfortable with the way that you use the word spiritual, because spiritual is breath. It's like I'm alive.
Yeah.
And
we link to everything.
And so a lot of times Einstein is a mentor, a role model for me, because here you have a scientist who is also a spiritual person. Mm-hmm. Not an Old Testament, you know, that kind of God person, but a very spiritual person, you know, just amazed at how different things work. So, feeling is the only reward we will ever have in this life. Mm-hmm. This is something I've realized going older, because I'm a task-oriented person. You know, you get this task done, you check it off, and then go do another task. But, and by the way, just a natural part of the aging process is that a task-oriented person gains more feeling. You know, I've got 4 grandchildren now, and I'm realizing the value system to change. So, but the realization, now being a task-oriented person, realizing, oh my, you know, feeling is all there is. We need to structure this, I'm the administrator, structure this life, you know, so that we feel good more of the time and get control of this mental state, you know, so that we can be happy.
So how do you do it for yourself?
How do I do it for myself? I work out pretty much every day. I'm going to the gym for an hour. I'm not a workout lunatic, but you know, I'll run a mile or two and I'll do some exercises. My body feels good.
And you get
good.
Your chemical high, honestly.
That's right. That's right. And when you read the research on this, you get the and there's no side effects. I mean, the side effects are positive.
There are no negative side effects. Yeah.
Well, not that I'm aware of.
Except the if you exercise, but you parts of your body and damage them.
If you go to extremes. But so what do? I mean, I can't imagine living without, you know, regular exercise. And I'm a self-motivated, self-directed mm-hmm. learner. You talk about curiosity. I want to learn something today. So, yep. I will be listening to some lecture or some book, when I'm running or working out or driving a car. So always keeping the mind interested. And my interests are my interests. It's like I actually had trouble with school. Like, I don't want to learn what you guys tell me I want to learn. I want to learn this. Uh-huh. And now I'm old enough that I can, like, decide what I want to learn. So how do I take care of myself?
And how do you know you need to?
Exercise? Well, I once told a person I would rather, exercise than eat, because I feel good when I'm done exercising. And a lot of times when I'm done eating, I just feel like blah. Uh-huh, so It's like, go take the drugs, go to the right, gym, get the drugs,
Right. And so when do you know that you haven't taken care of yourself? When have things fallen apart?
Well, there's times in my life when other people can really make my life difficult.
Right.
And how do I do that? Especially when I was younger, I would go for really long runs, maybe that's not fair, but that's my drug.
But it's also, but your stimulus was other people made your life miserable.
I think another thing, and it's actually, my daughter's a therapist, and my son teaches in the Himalayas. He's an outdoor guy, but
sure.
in similar ways, they both model the kind of things that I'm going to say. I return to nature, and my daughter talks about the need for feeling belonging. Like, when the humans are being a pain, it's like, at least I can turn to nature. It's like, go out there and say, I belong here. I feel okay here.
Right.
So it's kind of those three things. I try to resolve things, and I'll go the extra distance. I'll take responsibility for my part, and then at some point I just have to say, okay, I've been fair to this person. I don't agree with them.
Right.
I just need to let go of this, and that's when I go for a run. And it's like, nature always takes me in.
Right.
It's kind of like the sun's still up there. It's just one planet, and that's what I do.
Right. And when you hit the brick wall, which is the other or the thing that is totally unsettling you, then you can back off and go to another place.
It's not worth feeling miserable all day, every day. Just stop banging my head against the wall and,
Yeah, and that is probably the key challenge of self-directed, self-motivated learners, is learning how not to keep beating the wall.
Well, I'm still learning that, but
that's part of that.
But that's key. I'm going to agree with you there.
Right. So, you wanted to close with a piece of music that you performed at your mother's funeral.
Yes, that's right.
And I wanted you to just take a moment to describe why that piece of music, why close this show with that?
Wow. I could go for an hour on that.
I know.
My mother was the absolute most important figure in my life. She was a phenomenal role model. I mean, she stood behind me. She told me I could do anything, and she kind of lived her life through my adventures, because uh-huh. she had six kids and she's taking care of the kids. She lived her life through all.
What order are you? Where are you in the order?
I'm number two, so I fixed a lot of pipes and things and mowed the grass and she would she just give me all these praise about how well I do things, and then I would just keep doing them. That was my childhood.
Yeah.
But as I got older, we also shared a spiritual part, and then the walk across Arizona, calling every 10 days. And my mother died very suddenly at the age of 81. We thought that she would outlive my dad. My dad is now 91. That's another story. But so it happened very suddenly. She had a stroke, and all of the children gathered in Minnesota, and we had to express our appreciation for our mother. And so I remember we were at the home. We had a house on the lake. And there was a piece that I played on my harmonica when I was walking across Arizona. And I modified it a little bit for the service. But I stepped outside the house and I just started playing this tune for my mother over and over and over again to a full moon. And we talked to the Roman Catholic priest. And I said, look, I want to play this.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of looked at me like, sometimes this doesn't work out. And my brother Tony stepped up. He said, he can play.
Yeah.
And so I practiced in this church. And by the way, a harmonica in a church is a phenomenal sound. Yeah. I didn't think that a harmonica, no microphone, it fills the church. And my sister listened to it and said, just play that. And so, obviously, at the service, my mother's casket is there, and it's like, this is my farewell. And, you know, you stand up in front of the altar, and all of my relatives are there, but that doesn't matter. This is flow. It's like, just block all of that out. And say what you need to say with music. And it was Joseph Campbell that pointed out that there's times when we express things in music that we can't possibly express in words.
Right.
And so it's like, say what needs to be said here. And so this is my attempt, you know, to say what needs to be said with a harmonica, to see my mother off and say, thank you very much, mother, because what you did for me is just unbelievable. So that's it.
Well, thank you, Dan. And that's what we'll close the show with. Thank you. It's been wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you, Eric.